The Honorable Daniel R. Foley, Alexa D. M. Fujise, and Lisa M. Pinoza presiding. Please be seated. Case number CAAP-11-1072, Roaring Lion LLC et al. v. Exclusive Resorts CBL1 LLC. Marjorie S. Bronster and Rex Y. Fujikaku for plaintiff appellants, Robert G. Klein, R. John Seibert, and Lisa W. Cataldo for defendants appellees. Argument on the merits.
Ms. Bronster.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm here this morning on behalf of the appellants in appeal number 1072. I will be representing the same people who appear as appellees in our next argument. But on behalf of Roaring Lion, David and Natalie Cohen, Umang and Ruth Gupta, and Boa Beach 8 LLC, I want to thank you for hearing oral argument on this matter this morning. We're here to discuss why appellants believe that the court erred in ruling that Exclusive Resorts activities at Boa Beach were barred by the relevant CCNRs and local rules and laws. Essentially, in a series of motions for summary judgment and partial summary judgment, the court determined that Exclusive Resorts operations were perfectly okay. And in essence, what he looked at, the court looked at, was the fact, first he looked at whether or not their activities constituted commercial activity under the terms of the CCNRs, whether or not it constituted residential use under the CCNRs, and whether or not it constituted a timeshare. Because the Boa Beach locations that Exclusive Resorts had is part of a large resort which was known as Mauna Lani. And Mauna Lani had its own CCNRs, and it had a large and complex situation. There were certain areas that were set up for commercial, and certain areas for hotels and resort, and certain areas that were for residential use only. And the Paoa Beach Resort was for residential use only. Now, in looking at this issue, there are really two things we have to consider. One is the fact that Exclusive Resorts is a destination club. And what it does is self-proclaimed for it is a luxury destination club, according to its own materials, for a fee of $375,000 upfront and a fee of $9,500 to $30,000 per year. Each member has the right to use club facilities for either 30, 45, or up to 60 days.
And these club facilities are spread throughout the world.
Yes, that's correct. They may select the ER facilities in Hawaii, or they may select some somewhere else. And as I will go into a little bit later, we believe that the fact that they can go one place to another does not make it residential use. In fact, this issue does come up with respect to timeshares. And as I will show, the statute specifically contemplates the idea of these uses being circulated amongst many people, potentially here, potentially elsewhere.
Wasn't timeshare, as it was originally envisioned by the legislature, you know, targeting a cell within Hawaii, Kalakau Avenue, to hotels specifically located within the state with use in that particular hotel throughout the year? Isn't that what they pretty much had in mind?
Actually, that may have been the original idea, but over time what happened was timeshare processes and timeshare plans changed. And so instead of being what you think of as the traditional timeshare ownership plan, which is you own a vested interest in one unit, which you get on a specific date, they morphed. And the statute matches the reality, which is sometimes you have an ownership plan, and we're not arguing this is an ownership plan, and sometimes you have a use plan. And in the case of a use plan, it is any sort of interest in a variety of issues. Let me pull out the statute. And specifically in the definitions, I think they're instructive. A use plan specifically is any arrangement where by a membership agreement, a party has a right to use facilities, accommodations, or both for a specific or discernible time period by temporal division, but does not receive any ownership interest. And notably, the introduction to the definition of timeshare plan has the concept of this circulating amongst many people, because it says a timeshare plan means any plan or program in which the use, occupancy, or possession of one or more units, so it's not always the same unit, it's one or more units, circulates amongst various persons, all the members of this plan, for less than 60-day period in any year for any occupant. So as long as you have any occupant who has it for less than 60 days, it can circulate amongst a variety of people. And the statute specifically defines timeshare as one of these membership plans that can circulate.
And even if it's not among owners but just users, aren't they supposed to have an association of owners to run it?
Okay, they are supposed to. But I think that what ER has done, and I think, unfortunately, ER used the same argument below successfully, and we think erroneously. What ER is saying is, we didn't meet the requisites of a timeshare, and therefore we can't be a timeshare. But that's not what's prohibited. It's not whether or not you're being a good timeshare, because anyone can just violate the law and then say, well, we're not a timeshare because we haven't met all the requisites. What is prohibited under the CCNRs is any plan that would be subject to the chapter. Not that meets all the requisites of the chapter, but would be subject to the chapter. And the way to determine whether it would be subject to the chapter is to look at the definitions. If they then go and ignore all the requirements, countings, and this
it's
and
subject
that.
To the chapter, it says less than 60 days or 60 days or less. Isn't that in the chapter to be the timeshare?
It says it circulates among various people for less than a 60-day period in any year for any occupants.
And this plan, as pointed out in the answering brief, you can actually be more than 60 days.
Okay, but
that's the plan, right?
No, actually, there is a possibility. The plan is that it's, if you look at their offering materials that are in the record, it says that no one can be there for more than 14 days unless certain exceptions. And presumably, and what they argued is that you could have more. Well, there are two issues here. One is we believe it's a question of fact. And in fact, the record shows that there were admissions that no one ever had stayed for more than 60 days. But I think that there's a more important distinction, and that is that with respect to timeshares, if you're a timeshare owner or a timeshare user under a plan, you may rent a unit for additional time so that any timeshare plan could have people there potentially for more than 60 days, which would throw every single timeshare plan out of the statute if the court below was correct. And we believe the court below was not correct. And we believe that the legislature in implementing this and passing this was not looking to allow somebody to get out of this.
Now, the way this declaration or restrictive covenant was written, they basically made themselves hostage to whatever the legislature decided was a timeshare, 514E. There was nothing that prohibited Mauna Lani or Roaring Lion or whoever for writing these declarations more broadly, 514E or something similar. I mean, and aren't we supposed to construe these covenants in narrowly?
No, actually, this is, while covenants are supposed to be construed narrowly, the timeshare statute is not. And if you take a look at the Reef case.
I mean, but whether or not it comes within 514E, if there's any question?
No, Your Honor, we believe that the Reef Share case versus Nagata, 70 Hawaii 93, specifically says that the timeshare statute should be viewed because it is a remedial statute, it should be viewed broadly. And in that case, they specifically looked at the manner in which the 514E is interpreted and said it should be considered broadly. It also says that the application of HRS 514E, and in that case it was 6B, to plaintiff's application for timeshare registration is consistent with the protective purpose and policy of the statute, that the timesharing and transient vacation rentals should not be permitted where the lifestyles of permanent residents will be disrupted in an unreasonable manner, citing to both the statute and the legislative history. And they then went on to say, after applying the statute, they said, we carry out our primary duty of interpreting and applying statutes to ascertain the intent of the legislature and to implement the intent to the fullest degree possible. And what they thought was important was you look at the distinction between residential use and resort type use. The timeshare case, the Reef Share case goes on to talk about the distinctions, and it talks about what the residents' expectations would have been. Were they going to be in a residential location, or were they going to be in a resort with hotel-like neighbors? And we would request that you take a look at this, because this is precisely the type of situation that was faced in Reef Share and found to be a timeshare that we believe that exclusive resorts is similar as well.
Ms. Ronster, if I could ask you, you mentioned earlier that with regards to the 60-day limit that's in the definition of a timeshare plan under for 514E-1, that under the exclusive resorts marketing materials or their destination plan,
yes,
that a unit could only be used for 14 days subject to some extensions. Can you explain that a little further in terms of what is in the record on that point?
Yes. Basically, what the exclusive resorts material said was that they could, in their club agreement, you could make a reservation for 14 days, subject to extension up to, I believe it was 21 days, if the unit was not otherwise occupied. And what the testimony was that under certain circumstances, if there were no other reservations, people could use all of their time in one resort, but not consecutively, up to and potentially over 60 days.
Depending on their plan, the type of plan that they had, whether it would be the available days that they had.
It's the availability of the unit. They only had 60 days. As a maximum, but they could buy additional time, presumably. But again, if the fact that they could possibly buy additional time takes it out of a timeshare plan and out of the statute, then every single timeshare plan would get out of it because out of the statute, because there is no prohibition in most timeshare plans that prevent people from renting other people's units. In fact, that's one of the things that happens, is that these are exchanged, these are used, and if every single timeshare plan could say, but it could be used by someone who owns multiple units or who exchanges, and it could end up being more than 60 days, then every single timeshare unit and every single timeshare owner would be out of the statute, and we would have no regulation.
But that's just based, that's based on your general knowledge of timeshare, or is that something in the statute that you can point to?
I believe that that is, I cannot cite to you something in the statute, but I believe that the exchange plans do not talk about anything in terms of limits, and this is an exchange plan. And again, what the court was saying is that there could be, this is a possibility, and a hypothetical possibility, at the very least, is a question of fact that we should have had an opportunity to pursue, and it should not have been determined on a motion for summary judgment.
Whose testimony were you referring to when you said that, when they were talking about the 14 days and the extensions?
The 14 days is contained in the ER agreement, which is at the record on appeal at 8-403 is where the agreement and plan is. I believe that there was an admission that no one has ever used it for more than 60 days at the record on appeal at 6-803. I have 5 minutes left at this point that I'd like to, and then I reserve time, that I would like to talk a bit about the commercial activity. Because I think that when you look at the commercial activity, the case law in the state of Hawaii requires that you look at the entire context. Whether it's the Magby case or the Mon case, you have to look at what was the intent of the covenants. And in the determination of the intent of the parties, it is the entire context that must be looked at. And that is both of those cases. And what the CCNRs say is that you have to look at not only the CCNRs of Boa Beach, but also of the whole resort and also of the zoning laws. And those zoning laws include the requisites of a hotel. Under Hawaii County, a hotel is a building or group of buildings containing six or more rooms or suites which provide transient lodging or accommodation for compensation, whatever it is called. That is precisely what ER does. It has six or more rooms or suites which provide transient accommodation for compensation. As such, it violates the CCNR 15.4.1, because you cannot have something that is commercial under the county zoning code. There is no question, and even ER does not argue, that a hotel is anything other than commercial. ER claims that what you have to do is look only at what the residents do. And that's enough. You don't have to look at ER's motivations or activities. But that's not correct. The teaching of the cases in Hawaii and elsewhere show that looking only at the use within the unit is insufficient. In Magby, you had people residing there. It happened to be a care home, a convalescent home. But what they were doing was residing. But it wasn't residential, according to the Supreme Court. It was commercial because of what the owner did. Similarly with DeMond, you have to look at the owner. And here, you have to look at what ER does. Similarly, within the covenants, you have a definition of commercial apartments, which are not allowed at Pa'ola Beach. And that is a building or unit which is owned substantially by one owner, like ER, and is rented or leased for profit, like ER. These things come directly out of the CCNRs, and when you look at the entire context of the CCNRs, you will see that ERs, even if it is not a timeshare, it certainly is commercial and would be prohibited in the location at Pa'ola Beach.
How do we read the language then in the Pa'ola Beach Declaration, which specifically acknowledges that residential use can be for transient or permanent?
It was intended to allow owners, businesses to rent out their units on either a temporary or a permanent basis. But what the court did below, which we believe is an error, was it said that just because you can rent it out on a temporary basis, transient use, it automatically makes it residential. That automatically lets everything be okay. And the problem with that is that that would make a hotel okay. That if the hotel next door bought a bunch of units, they could just put hotel users in there, and it would somehow be allowed. And so you cannot look only at the use or the fact that it can be rented. Because if you look at the context as a whole, you will see that the intent was to make it a distinction between where the resort was next door and the residential uses here in a community which, under reef share and under the legislative history, the residents were entitled to have non-commercial, non-resort-like use.
So I would be prohibited as an individual from buying six units and renting them out?
I think what the courts, what the cases tell us is, and particularly DuMond is instructive on that, you have to look at what the full context is. Because DuMond was a similar type case where you had an individual, a developer, who took a small number of units and was turning them into potentially multi-family units. And what the court said is, under that context, even though the people inside were just residing, it wasn't residential because of the full context. And I think you'd have to look at that here. I would go on, but my time is up, and I'll be back.
Thank you. Thank you. Cyber?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm John Cyber, representing the defendant appellees, Exclusive Resorts, PB 1 and 3. If I may, I'd like to begin by addressing the residential use restrictive covenant, and I think it would be instructive to note what is not in dispute in this record. It's not in dispute that as at the time Judge Nakamura decided this issue, the construction of PBL 1 and 3's units had not been complete. So no Destination Club members had stayed there, therefore there was no evidence in the record as to what they would be doing in terms of their conduct. So the motions were briefed based upon expectancies, and there was really no dispute as to those expectancies that the club members would act in a recreational way when they showed up. In other words, there was never an allegation, there was never any evidence by the plaintiffs that the club members would engage in any sort of gainful occupation, profession, or trade, which is the way commercial activity is defined under the use restriction in question. And in fact, for all intents and purposes, there was really no issue that when the club members showed up that they would be acting any differently than the plaintiffs when the time came that their homes were built and they would be going there. They'd be using the pool, presumably, the golf course, whatever the amenities are in this world-class resort. So and then the final point that was not in dispute, as we heard once again from Ms. Bonster, is that the key residential use restriction of the Pahoa Beach subdivision declaration says owners may rent their property, including may engage in transient rentals, which of course includes short-term rentals. We cited in our answering brief an advertisement by, I think it was the only home that had been constructed and completed as of the time of the litigation of these motions, in which that particular owner was advertising its home for a rack rate of nearly $1,900 per night. So what's the issue? The issue really is, what should the court focus on when deciding whether or not commercial activity was involved here? We say it should be based upon the conduct of the occupants in residence, whether they be full-time occupants or transient occupants. The plaintiffs say no, you should look at the process by which the occupants were brought into the property.
Mr. Cyber, yes. Just if I could interrupt you a moment on your first point. Although, the exclusive resorts, had not been operational at the time Judge Nakamura ruled, didn't the promotional materials for the club, which would include this site on the Big Island, put itself forth saying its amenities of a five-star resort, complete staffing on site, housekeeping, chefs, massage, fleets of automobiles, I mean, more than residential. Wasn't that the promotional materials for all of their facilities?
It was with respect to those that were in operation, none of which were at the Palo Beach subdivision. And as we pointed out, when you are dealing with a property at this price point, those sorts of amenities would be expected.
So whether that was going to happen or not would be a question of fact then, when they begin operations.
It was not disputed that something like that would happen.
It would happen.
Yes. And as we point out, the Palo Beach subdivision itself had on-site concierge service, which was also available to the plaintiffs, for example. So you might be talking about a matter of degree.
It's not a question of fact, though. I mean, we don't have enough to know how it's going to be operating, right?
Well, in that case, you could say that because of no operation. But when the parties are not disputing how it's going to be operated with respect to concierge service off-site, for example, is there really an issue of fact?
This was all going to be off-site?
There was a declaration we submitted in the record indicating that the ER concierge service would be off-site. It would not be on-site such as that which already existed.
And the massage would be off-site, too?
That I do not know.
We don't know.
Do not know.
And the chefs would be off-site, or they would be coming to the residents to prepare?
That is my understanding, but I don't know that. If you were to ask me where the record is that said, I cannot point to that. So.
And the housekeeping clearly would be on-site.
Yeah, well, or they would come from somewhere else, obviously, just like the that one owner who was offering his property at 1900 a night indicated twice a week housekeeping and living changing, that sort of thing. But the plaintiffs say that you should be looking at the means by which the club members are brought on site. And so our response simply is, what if you own your own unit? It's a vacation property. You want to recoup your investment. You want to be able to rent it out as much as you can. It is implicit in the fact that the covenant allows you to engage in transit rentals, that you are also authorized to engage in commercial activity to secure those rentals. Because at these price points, people are not going to knock on your door. You're going to do something proactive to bring them in. It could be something as simple and, I think, ineffective as paying for a website to promote your property. You could go out and hire a broker to find high-income clients to come and rent your property and share with that broker a percentage of the night's rental fee. That's clearly commercial. Have you overstepped the line, as plaintiffs might suggest? Or as an individual owner, what if you actually found a destination club and entered into an agreement by which they would pay you so many dollars per night for each club member that comes to your property? Remember, PBL1 and PBL3 were not the operators of this destination club, and they are the only defendants in this case with respect to this particular issue. They just owned the units. They were going to assign the units to the destination club to bring people in. So the means we would submit are inherent in the ability, the permission to use the property as a transient, as a transient rental. And as long as it is expected, and there was no dispute in the record, that those club members would be engaging in recreational activities, the residential use restriction is not offended, and Judge Nakamura did not err in reaching that conclusion.
How do you distinguish the case where the property was used as a nursing home? Ms. Bronster referred to that case.
In the Cheney case, the owner itself actually set up the operation of the property as a nursing home. So it knew it was going to be running a commercial endeavor in that particular property. And the end use is more than just a nursing home resident sitting there on the rocking chair. Clearly, a nursing home would entail other such things as taking care of, feeding those individuals. So you clearly had a residential type activity. And of course, ultimately, you have to look at the language of the restrictive use covenant there. And I think the court hung its hat on a prohibition against boarding houses. And that's what they thought this was like. So if I may turn to timeshares then. The essence of this argument is the plans are trying to fit the proverbial square peg in the round hole. There are just too many differences between what the timeshare statute says the timeshare plan should be all about and what the destination club is all about. You can start with the part of the definition Ms. Bronster referred to where the timeshare statute says that, at least in part, that these units should circulate amongst a group of people for a given year. Nothing circulates under the luxury destination club plan. There's a portfolio of properties that can be subtracted to and added to at will. The club members have no right or interest to use any of those properties. You could very well be thinking about joining this club. You look at the glossy portfolio of properties and you see $5,000 for 60 days usage. You do that, and then you say, I'd like that chateau. And they said, I'm sorry, we have removed it from the portfolio. That is totally within the rights of the club membership's operation. That's not the way a timeshare plan would operate. Even if the timeshare plan gave you a choice of properties on Oahu, you would know what those properties were. Under the destination club plan, your entitlement is based upon first come, first served basis, space availability. That sort of dovetails into the other part of the definition of a timeshare plan, that it provides for an opportunity to use a timeshare property for a specific or discernible period by temporal division, meaning a specific period of time. There is no entitlement to use a destination club property for a specific identifiable period of time because properties are available only on a first-come, first-served basis. And even beyond those definitions, the timeshare statute, as your questions indicated earlier, have a whole host of requirements and plans that don't exist, from voting rights to a membership organization to the ability of the timeshare plan to levy against a member's failure to pay assessments and foreclose on their interests, to the right of a timeshare member to sell or transfer its interests. None of those things are present in the destination club plan. Your only right is to get your 80% back and not pay next year's dues, and then you can walk away, a different animal. As Ms. Bronster indicated, when the timeshare plans were set up, much of this mechanism, particularly with respect to the requirement for a discernible period of time during which the unit circulates, was to protect against overselling. We have cited some legislative history to that effect. I am not aware that there is anything in the record reflecting the way in which timeshares have morphed over time. Somehow they're different animals and make them look like destination clubs. I don't see that in the record. I'm just not aware that it was ever argued in the record.
Mr. Seibert, what about the assertion by Ms. Bronster that, you know, if you can, that under timeshares, you can extend your stays for beyond 60 days as well, with regards to the 60-day limit that is in the timeshare statute?
I'm not aware of it at all. I just don't know. I've never seen that in the record. I may have missed it. I don't know that it was in the record. I didn't see the plaintiffs mention it in their opening brief or their reply brief.
Okay. And what about the assertion that under ER's plan, or the marketing plan or whatever plan is in the record, that occupants can only use a unit for 14 days subject to certain extensions?
Right, plus 7. That's correct. The less than 60-day requirement for timeshare statute leasement has got to be based upon the aggregate total usage that you are entitled to during a given year. Under ER's plan, you are entitled to, if you're a platinum-level member, to use your plan for a total of 60 nights. You may only be able to use it in 14 to 21-day increments unless there is no one else who wants to use that particular property. But that is, the bottom line is you have to look at the total aggregate usage to which a member or a timeshare member is entitled to, and they are definitely different numbers, different animals in that respect. The sponsor indicated that just because the Luxury Destination Club plan does not have a membership requirement, I mean an association requirement or voting rights or any of the other list of things we have indicated, should not disqualify it from being considered a timeshare plan because otherwise it would be a way of avoiding regulation under the timeshare statute. But when you are dealing with an animal whose organic parts are so different from a timeshare animal, that argument breaks down. It's almost, I realize this is somewhat simplistic, but it does go to the point. If I were holding a daisy in my hand, the plaintiff's counsel said, no, that's really a rose, and I go, but this daisy does not have petals, it does not have thorns, and plaintiff's counsel said, well, the fact that you've chosen not to have something with petals and thorns doesn't really change the fact that we believe it's a rose. We have to look at the overall way in which both the timeshare plan is supposed to operate and the destination club.
What about Ms. Bronster's point that it operates like a hotel under the
county? Well, a couple of points there. First of all, they abandoned that argument below, and we've established that in our answer in brief. Secondly, the Hawaii Code indicates two things of interest. One of them says their definition of hotel units exclude timeshare. So if the plaintiffs are going to make that argument, presumably they're going to give up their argument that we're dealing here with timeshares. Secondly, the county code describes hotels of six or more units. We here, with respect to PBL1, constructed four duplexes. They were total homes. with full-size kitchens, bedrooms, multiple bathrooms. So based upon a common and ordinary understanding of what a home is like versus a hotel room or a suite, we submit they are different animals as well. Finally, I would note that at the end of the day, when we look at these two animals, they are so different that it really strains any sort of logic and credibility to bring them together. And therefore, we think Judge Nakamura was correct in his assessment. Obviously, this court's review is de novo. You can start with a clean slate. But when you look at the undisputed record, the absence of evidence, when you apply Thomas V. Pagani and the Celotex and Carteret decision of the U.S. Supreme Court concerning what we have to establish as the parties not bearing the burden of persuasion of the trial, a summary judgment was appropriate. We believe for that reason the decision should be sustained.
It's not part of the record, but if your client begins operating those units with on-site services, could Ms. Bronster's clients go in then and get an injunction? You say right now there's nothing on site other than maybe housekeeping, but if the chefs are on site, massage is on site, fleet of automobiles, if these units are being serviced on site, could she then go in and
yeah, we would say under Dr. Restricata, the judge should dispose of that issue because all of this was presented to the court as something that the parties anticipated happening. So presumably that was taken into account when he examined the scope of the rest.
And was the promotional material from Exclusive Resorts presented to the judge?
That was part of the record that was before the judge.
And your response to that was, we're not operating, we don't know what's going to happen?
No, I think the response at that time was, it doesn't really matter. Moreover, this promotional activity is the sort of thing you would expect.
Would it have mattered if that was going on at the site at the time?
No, because it would be the sort of amenity you would expect to be made appropriately available at this price. But if you're charging someone close to $2,000 a night, any owner, would do what they needed to do to attract people at that price point, and this would seem to be okay. First of all, if you think of it, it's a non-intrusive action. It does not have anything to do with the conduct of the occupants. And again, we go back to
and it's not gainful occupation,
no.
Profession or trade. None of
no.
these services it's, fall within that.
It is a means of inducing those recreating occupants to come.
I mean, but the actual activity, the therapist is not a trade?
The therapist may be a trade, but it would be a into having a house cleaner come from outside and clean the unit once a week.
And a chef is not a trade?
Yes, those are trades.
Okay, then what does occupation, profession, or trade mean then? It's a restrictive covenant. What does it mean if it doesn't mean anything?
Since the broader part of the covenant authorizes transient rentals, it has to refer to the conduct of the occupant itself, that is the renter. And if the renter's conduct is residential, that is the end of the inquiry.
So occupation, profession, or trade restrictive covenant doesn't apply to your unit?
Yes, that's correct. That was our position below. Thank you all very much.
The timing of the motions were before substantial discovery was done, and there are questions of fact, but the record does include information about an on-site concierge. She was deposed. We have her testimony in part set out page 11 of our brief, but it is at the record on appeal at 11.47. And as we explain, the ER members started using the subdivision club from April 2004, and the on-site concierge wrote that the intensive use by the members of the beach club had become a burgeoning problem. And what she explained, I won't take the time to read it to you, you can see it in the record, what she explained was these people treated it like a hotel. This was a resort-like use, and resort-type users and homeowners treat their facilities very differently.
Which units were these people using? And are these units that were owned by the same entities that are parties to this lawsuit?
Yes. Basically what happened was they had acquired not only certain units where houses were built, but they also acquired lots where they built condominiums, duplexes. So they were far more condensed. I mean, there was more intensive use of their properties than anywhere else.
So lot B was where they were going to build certain duplexes.
Certain of them.
So what other lots did these parties that are party to this lawsuit, the ER parties that are party to this lawsuit, own and rent out for transient use?
ER constructed 4 duplex units on lot B, and ER3 through ER acquired 5 of 9 Nahali condominium units located in lot 17 through 23, and those were the ones that were acquired. In total, there were 16 units owned by the ER.
So it's the condo units on lot 17 through 23 where, in the record, people had been already renting those units, and the concierge, whose declaration you referred to, was referring to people who were staying at units.
Statement from her, right.
Units, they were staying at units on lot 17 to 23.
Yes.
Okay.
And what she said was that they had 189 exclusive resort members at the facility since April, which was, I think, a couple of months later. They're here every day, 7 days a week, up to 30 people a day. They treat the facility with a hotel attitude.
Yeah, I remember reading that. What is the name of the declarant?
Paola Calciolari. The record also shows that there were 2,327 ER members in the first 9 months, and that's at the record on appeal 1166 to 68. So I think that when you take a look at all of the services which were anticipated to be on site, I think you get to the trade, business, or profession, unquestionably. But what I thought was interesting about ER's counsel's argument is he tried to make a distinction between the Magby case and this. And he said in that one, the court looked at the fact that the owner intended to have a convalescent home and intended to have it circulating amongst a lot of people for a profit. Well, that's no different than ER, who intended to have a destination club and intended to buy these and build these to have people coming in and on a transient basis to make money for a profit. It is far more akin to a hotel. Timeshare commercial activity than it is to residential use anticipated under the totality of the CCNRs. There is an argument here that we have abandoned the argument that this was a hotel, and that is simply not true. What they've done is they've taken out of context an argument that says, appellants are arguing the alternative. We believe that this is a timeshare. But if it is not a timeshare, we believe that it is, at the very least, commercial. We are allowed to argue in the alternative. And if it is a hotel, it doesn't fall into the timeshare statute. We agree with that. But so it does make it commercial, and we have not abandoned that.
So your argument is it's commercial because it falls under the ordinances as a hotel.
Correct.
You're not saying that it's commercial because it falls within what a commercial lot or unit as defined under the CCRs would define this.
No, I think that there are a number of different definitions of commercial that we believe apply and should be applied under the CCNRs. Because basically what the CCNRs say is you look at both the CCNRs at Boa Beach and the total resort, and the total resort talk about those commercial apartment type things that should only be in the commercial areas, not here. And it also says you also look at the zoning, and
right.
That's what brings in the hotel. So whether you're looking at the profession standard or whether you're looking at the commercial apartment standards or whether you're looking at the hotel standards, we believe that ER should be barred because it falls within any of those. And on the commercial apartments, that's defined as a building or unit which which is owned substantially by a single common entity, rented or leased for profit. These are all things that apply to ER.
ER's argument on that is that that's for voting purposes, right?
But
what's your response to that?
Okay. First of all, they're just wrong. What the commercial apartments are defined as, there's a definition of commercial apartments, and that's what I've just read to you.
Right.
They fit that. There are two places where commercial apartments are used in the resort CCNRs. The first one is where it says commercial apartments aren't to be had in the residential areas. The second place is where it says how the voting applies. But the critical one is in the argument where it says that you may not have commercial apartments in the residential areas.
Is that in Article 1? Where is that?
No, it's in... I believe... It's... Hold on just one second. I think I may have some assistance here.
Okay.
It's Record on Appeal 2:101. Where it is in the Matalani Resort CCNRs, and it talks about the distinction between the residential area and the commercial area, and it says, except in the case of commercial lots. So if you get specific permission to put a commercial lot into a residential area, no gainful occupation, profession, or trade shall be maintained in any lot or in any structure or in any lot without the prior approval of the board.
Right, that's Article 5. That's the specific provision that we're grappling with, right? Where is the definition of commercial lot then?
Oh, the definition of commercial lot is in the definition section of the...
That's going back to Article 1.
That's in Article 1. I'm sorry, I thought you wanted to know where the prohibition was. I apologize. I think ER
Ms.
also...
Ms. A few times up.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you very much. We'll be back when you're ready, maybe 5 minutes. We can start a few minutes early as soon as you're ready.
I think we're supposed to change locations.
Yes, and then we can start early if you're ready. So just notify the day of.